visit.
77th annual Paul Bunyan Days in Akeley. That begins today and goes through Sunday. Enjoy live music and activities all weekend. Classic car show Saturday 10 to 2 and the grand parade at 1 on Sunday. You have a dad who's into those classic car shows, right?
Yes.
Does he travel to them?
Not usually with his car.
Okay.
But he was at Back to the 50s last weekend, which is at the Minnesota State Fairgrounds. It's been going on for decades. It's a very big deal.
Has he gone many times?
Yes. I've gone myself several times. But yeah, the whole fairgrounds gets kind of covered with classic cars. So.
Oh, fun. It's summer. That's, the, you know, whether it's the classic car shows or water skiing events. Brainerd has a regular weekly water skiing, and I know we have another
in the Park Rapids water ski team. They're performing on this Saturday, 6 o'clock at Halverson Beach in Nevis. It's a free show. Bring your own chair, and the Nevis Lions Club will have food and beverage for purchase there.
Local news is next. It is 7:01.
For KAXE News, I'm Erin Bowman with the Up North Report. An anonymous donor has stepped forward to offer $30,000 in matching funds to the Grand Rapids Area Library to help extend its hours next year. To receive the grant, the library needs to raise its own $30,000 by September 1st. The donation was announced Wednesday at a community meeting at the library. The grant is part of the Supporting Our Grand Rapids Area Library Fund. Since its start last fall, the fund has raised $90,000 to support staff pay in 2027. Director of Library Services, Amy Detmer, says she's blown away by the support the library has received.
The monetary support and just the support emotionally. I mean, people have felt staff's pain. We want to do what we can, and it's been tough.
It was created in response to a decrease in funding from the city that resulted in staff and hour cuts. City Councilor Molly McGregor says the hope was for the county to pick up more of the funding. Mindy Nuring is the Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation Executive Director. She says the hope of the fund is to open the library 4 to 5 days during the work week and Saturday. Currently, the library is open 21 hours across 3 days. The official operating hours will be announced at the end of the year after the Grand Rapids City Council approves its 2027 budget. At the meeting, Nuring also announced that the Center for Rural Policy and Development has taken an interest in the issue. The center is a nonpartisan, nonprofit policy research organization dedicated to providing policymakers with unbiased information from rural perspectives. The center would research Minnesota's overall public library funding system, as well as different ways rural libraries could be funded. If pursued, the research would be shown to the state legislature in January. Google is trying to quell community concerns about its proposed Hermantown data center. The tech giant hosted its first open house Wednesday. The Duluth News Tribune reports hundreds of people lined up to speak with Google officials staffing various stations. The 1.2 million square foot data center would be built in the southwest corner of Hermantown and used for Google services and artificial intelligence. Google says its data center would be compliant with Minnesota laws, and an agreement with Minnesota Power means energy prices wouldn't go up. The company also notes its community partnership. State Representative Natalie Zalesnikar also attended the meeting. She told the News Tribune she is weighing the environmental impacts against the need for local economic development. The city of Akeley and the Hubbard County Sheriff's Office are at odds over how to handle non-emergency calls. The Park Rapids Enterprise reports Sheriff Corey Aukus sent an email to his deputies in April. It says that non-emergency calls in Akeley should be handled by Chief Jimmy Hansen, the city's only officer. If Hansen isn't on duty when the call comes in, Aukus says to tell people that their report will be given to Hansen when he's back on duty. The sheriff says, quote, "If the call is an emergency type of call, obviously I want you to respond. But gas drive-offs, dog complaints, and other calls can be handled by Hansen." Akeley Mayor Brian Hitchcock asked what constitutes an emergency. He says he feels the city has been singled out because Hansen is running for county sheriff. Aukus is running for Hubbard County Board instead of sheriff. He has endorsed a different candidate. According to the Enterprise, Aukus says his deputies can make a judgment call in the moment about what an emergency is. Hansen says he expects the office to deal with incidents when he is off duty. He says it's not normal for the sheriff to not be the primary law enforcement officer. Quote, "I have 26 years in law enforcement, and I have not seen that." A public data request by the Enterprise discovered emails from 2021 and 2024, where Aukus gives similar instructions about Akeley to his deputies. Aaron Stresso will be the new president of Leech Lake Tribal College. She's expected to start the position July 7th. Stressel will succeed former President Helen Zakina Montgomery and interim President Stacey Leon. There will be a meet and greet for Stressel from 1 to 2 p.m. July 21st in the drum room on campus. Stressel brings nearly two decades of leadership experience to the role. Her experience spans tribal government, nonprofits, and corporate environments. She holds a doctorate degree in business administration with focuses on organizational leadership and development. A release from the college says she, quote, is a transformative servant leader committed to advancing student success, institutional resilience, and community impact. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Erin Bowman, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
Good morning, it is 7:06, and this is People Powered KEXE on this Friday morning. Don't forget, we've got What's for Breakfast coming up at 7:45. That means it's your invitation to join us, share your breakfast with us. Of course, not literally, you don't have to give up any food, but you can join us. Text us this morning, 218-326-1234. I'm Heidi Holton.
I'm Jennifer Barr, and we receive support from Clacko Brewing Company in Grand Rapids, making traditional old world styles of beer and modern classics for 8 years now. Their tap room is open Monday through Thursday, 3 to 8, Friday and Saturday, noon to 8, Sunday, noon to 6. More at clackobrewing.com.
Coming up from National Public Radio, along with an update on the World Cup, we're learning about some changes that came from the U.S. Supreme Court having to do with immigration policy. And Marshall Helmberger's away today. We'll be also be hearing about local media, but local media in Indonesia and a community radio station there. So stay tuned. It is Friday morning.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Good morning. The U.S. Supreme Court gave President Trump more power to enact his immigration agenda on Thursday.
One decision allows the administration to move forward with revoking temporary legal status for hundreds of thousands of immigrants. The other puts limits on how immigrants can claim asylum.
NPR's immigration policy correspondent Jimena Bustillo is with us in studio to help us understand what this all means in practice. Good morning, Jimena.
Good morning.
Okay, let's start with TPS, or temporary protected status. What are the implications of this ruling?
In a 6-3 decision, the conservative majority ruled that the president has virtually unrestrained power to end the program known as TPS. This case was specifically about TPS recipients in Haiti and Syria, which total about 300,000 people, but it has broader implications. TPS provides deportation protections and it grants work permits, and it's given to people from specific countries affected by war, natural disasters, political instability, or any other condition that might make a country unsafe to return to. Each country's designation can last 6 to 18 months, and that's at the discretion of the Secretary of Homeland Security. Now, the court is agreeing with the government that making those designations is up to the secretary and not subject to legal review.
So what happens to hundreds of thousands of people who are in the U.S. on this program?
Well, they need to either adjust their status, which is very limited ways of doing so, or they need to leave the country. But if they don't, they risk falling out of status, and that could lead to an arrest, a detention, or a deportation. And many also face losing their jobs, as companies will not be able to continue legally employing thousands of workers. Ira Kurzban is the attorney representing the Haitian TPS holders.
Their families are American citizens. They have American citizen children. So we're talking in a practical manner with respect to all the TPS people. You're talking about millions of people in the United States who contribute to the economy.
He argues that Haiti, Syria, and other countries are not stable enough for people to return to, and many of these people have also been here for decades. He also said that the government could immediately begin deporting people if they have received final orders of removal while the cases have been pending in courts.
Now, there was also a second immigration decision from the court, this one related to asylum. Tell us about that one.
That was another 6-3 decision, and the court backed a policy that allows Customs and Border Protection agents to turn away asylum seekers before they cross the U.S. border. The order says asylum seekers need to fully cross the U.S. border to claim asylum, so essentially migrants who are turned back by border officials under this policy technically never left the physical side of the Mexican border. So the administration argues that they are ineligible to apply for legal protections to be in the U.S., and that ruling effectively further limits who can get permission to stay in the country.
Okay, so both of these decisions make it harder for immigrants to stay here or to get here. How does this play into the administration's goal of mass deportation?
Well, DHS General Counsel James Percival said that the decisions give the agency, quote, several more important tools to continue securing our borders. And President Trump has a broader goal of mass deportation. So to do that, the administration has been making more people eligible for deportation, even if they were already legally here. We've already seen the administration terminate TPS for nearly every country that has had it since the start of Trump's term, and the asylum ruling limits how migrants can ask for that permission to come into the U.S. These rulings allow the government to further change the immigration system.
That's NPR's Ximena Bustillo. Thank you, Ximena.
Thank you.
We've reported that some 300,000 people originally from Haiti are living in the U.S. with temporary protected status, several thousand of whom have settled in Springfield, Ohio. They were the targets of this false, ugly claim by President Trump in 2024 during a presidential debate airing on ABC.
In Springfield, they're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets.
As we said, repeatedly proven false, but the impact on the community was profound. There were bomb threats, there were rallies by white supremacists, and so on. That's something the Reverend Carl Ruby knows well. Reverend Ruby is a senior pastor at Central Christian Church in Springfield. His congregation includes many Haitians. He also founded Springfield Neighbors United and G92, dedicated to helping Haitians in Springfield who are facing deportation. So we've called him to ask how his community is reacting to this latest news. Reverend Ruby, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
You've obviously been following this closely. What have you been hearing so far from people in your community who could be affected by yesterday's ruling?
Well, I mean, yesterday was surreal in just the way that the tension hung over our city and particularly our Haitian community. And it was a whirlwind, and we're still trying to get a handle on it. But I was getting phone calls from members of the congregation asking if they should go to work. There were Haitians with me when we received the news, and they immediately began crying. So yesterday was a really, really hard day.
I can imagine. So, you know, Haiti has been facing many struggles. I mean, this has gone on for sort of quite some time, but immediately there have been all kinds of pressures, you know, the gang violence, et cetera, which has sort of been reported. How have people in the community been sort of dealing with that, knowing that there was the specter of being sent back?
People who are advocates for Haitians are very, very aware of that. People who have kind of an anti-immigrant bias, I think they totally ignore that information. And just to kind of give you an indication of what it's like pastoring Haitians during this time, I had a 12-year-old child just this last week who was in a children's program, and we were talking about pigs, and he immediately told a story about seeing feral hogs eating bodies back in Haiti. So these are people who have been severely traumatized before they ever arrived here. And, you know, I think your listeners can imagine the fear in a child's mind and heart having fled that. And this child survived a kidnapping attempt. He went on to talk about, you know, hiding in a classroom while there was shooting outside. So they know how awful it is. They know what they're being sent back to, and they're terrified.
Can you just tell us a bit more about the Haitian community in Springfield and its place in Springfield? What do people do there? How have they sort of rooted themselves in the community there?
Yeah, I mean, Springfield was a shrinking Rust Belt city before they arrived, and we had gone through 50 years of decline. When Haitians arrived, it was the first time Springfield grew. We went from being one of the fastest shrinking cities to the fastest growing city. They fueled our economy. They started businesses. Businesses that were already here added shifts. New businesses came because of the Haitian workforce. So they've had a huge impact, and they show up everywhere. And most of them are professional people who are doing manual labor jobs because their certifications don't apply here. So they're very popular with employers. I've talked to one factory owner in town. He said they always show up. They work as much as they can, and they never fail drug tests. Mm-hmm. So they're the ideal employees. They're exactly what Springfield needs.
We only have about 30 seconds left, but is there any recourse that you're aware of so that people wouldn't have to leave?
There really isn't. I mean, we're encouraging people to apply for asylum. If they have an asylum pending case, that slows the process down. But no, there are no options. And we need a legislative fix to our immigration system. And until then, it's going to be one crisis like this after another.
That's the Reverend Carl Ruby. He's senior pastor, Central Christian Church in Springfield, Ohio. Reverend Ruby, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
The U.S. men's national soccer team got its first loss in the FIFA World Cup last night against Turkey. But the result doesn't change anything for the Americans, who had already clinched their spot in the knockout phase of the tournament. NPR's Becky Sullivan reports from Los Angeles.
It was a rowdy crowd of more than 70,000 who turned out in sunny Southern California to see the rare World Cup game that didn't really matter. Win, lose, or draw, Turkey had already been eliminated, and the U.S. had already won their group, and with it, an advantageous path in the knockout round starting next week. Because of that, U.S. coach Mauricio Pochettino chose to rest most of his usual starters and instead fielded a team of players who hadn't had that much playing time at all. Still, they had wanted to win, said forward Brendan Aaronson.
Lost the game, but I don't think it was a game to lose. We had a lot of chances, and, you know, we could have done better in some defensive plays, but, you know, it happens. You make 10 changes, you know, the team might not be used as, you know, the guys that have been playing.
Defender Austin Trusty and midfielder Sebastian Berhalter scored the two American goals, but the B team defense was leaky and gave up a pair of goals in the first half. Then, after keeping up a 2-2 tie for most of the second, Turkey scored the winner in the final minute of the game. One bright spot was the return of star winger Christian Pulisic, who came on in the second half as a sub to a big standing ovation. Pulisic didn't score, but he had one great chance and gave Aaronson another.
Just having him come into the game, he makes such a difference. You know, a lot of attention, of course, goes to him. So other guys, you know, have moments to, you know, have chances and stuff like that, too. But yeah, he came on. He was electric as always.
The U.S. men had gotten off to their hottest start ever at the World Cup. This loss does cool them off a bit. But Pochettino says he's not worried about the result.
What we need to remember that we won the first place in this group. We ended up being number one.
Manejando muy bien las expectativas y la presión.
And we managed all of the pressure and the expectations quite well.
In the press conference after the game, as reporters questioned him about slowing momentum and lessons learned, Pochettino grew impatient with what he saw as too much negativity.
I think it's all positive, and I am so positive, and I am happy. Maybe I am not showing because your questions are a little bit weird, but I am so happy, and the players are happy because I think we perform, we compete, and we are first.
That first place finish means that next Wednesday in the knockout phase, the Americans will face Bosnia and Herzegovina. The U.S. will be the favorites. Becky Sullivan, NPR News, Los Angeles.
This is NPR News.
You'll hear more on World Cup coming up at 8:40 with Football is Life. We've got DJ Deng, Chris Walker, fingers crossed, Malachi Coons, and a special guest as well. Should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think what I love most about soccer, as a person who knows nothing about soccer, is the music.
Ah, there you go.
It's fun. It's just Football is Life.
Yes. People are having so much fun when they show the crowds and the, yeah, it is amazing what is happening, the amount of people, and, you know, for our eyes to be open to how popular this sport is and what it means to the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty cool. So that's coming up today at 8:40, And before that, we'll have the sports page, Fred Friedman and Kyle Erickson. Up next, we're going to be learning about a community radio station in Indonesia and the latest installment of StoryCorps.
Support comes from the Mental Health Crisis Response Team of Itasca County. This crisis intervention service is a program of first call for help, 211, and provides free crisis assessments, stabilization services, referrals, and resourcing to residents of any age who are in crisis. Available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by dialing 211.
You can celebrate life with pride at the Headwaters Peace Center in Bemidji this Sunday from 10 to 1. Enjoy live music, prizes, activities, snacks, and resources. And also on Sunday, but in Grand Rapids, is Unfinished Freedom, 250 years on, a community festival at the Yanmar Arena, the pavilion next to Yanmar. Enjoy live music, food trucks, 1 to 8, featuring Paul Metza, Sam Miltich and friends, Scarlett Woods, and many more. Bring your own chair. You should bring your own chair to the Beltrami Block Party tomorrow as well.
All right. I would say summertime, always have those chairs ready to go in your car.
Yeah.
Brainerd Animal Hospital presents Pups in the Park tomorrow from 10 to 2 at Lum Park in Brainerd. You can see dog demos throughout the event. Plus, there is a pie-eating contest for both kids and dogs. Silent auction, crafts, food, and much more to raise funds for the Babinski Foundation Animal Shelter. Support comes from the Lake Country Journal, a local lifestyle magazine sharing stories about places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. More at lakecountryjournal.com.
Tomorrow, Watermark Art Center in Bemidji has an outdoor artisan market on their south lawn from 9 to 1. You can shop art, flowers, locally made foods, and more with live indigenous flute music by Frankie Graves.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. In the shadow of Indonesia's highly active Mount Merapi, traditional community radio networks are being replaced by smartphones and social media for information about disasters. But there's a trade-off for faster warnings. Naina Rao has more.
On the slopes of Indonesia's Mount Merapi, farmer Mujianto unlocks a building he helped keep alive for years. Behind the rusted door is a dusty, abandoned radio station that once helped villagers survive one of the world's most active volcanoes. Mujianto points to the empty corners of the room, explaining that this used to be the main broadcast booth. In the early 2000s, government warnings often struggled to reach Merapi's remote mountain villages. So local farmers pooled their own money and built MMC FM, a community radio station, from scratch. It aired live reports from people working on the volcano slopes like this one back in 2007. Today, the station is silent. Its equipment broke during the pandemic, and volunteers couldn't afford repairs. But Mujianto says that's not the main reason it disappeared.
The culture has taken a complete 180-degree turn. Audiences today don't just want to listen to a voice on the radio. With digitalization, they now want visuals.
Research from the Reuters Institute shows Indonesians increasingly consume news through social media and video platforms now. So the community here traded the analog dial for the smartphone screen. But Mujianto worries about what happens when information is driven purely by algorithms.
On the old community radio frequencies, neighbors trusted the voices on the air because they knew the broadcasters were the very same farmers working the fields next to them. Digital platforms like Instagram or TikTok care about what goes viral, not necessarily what is true.
Mujianto says misleading posts like old videos of past eruptions shared as if Merapi is erupting in real time sometimes circulate online. Today, when he's not farming, Mujianto spends some time filtering rumors about Merapi online, cross-checking information with local authorities before forwarding verified updates to neighbors on WhatsApp groups. Those same groups are now central to Merapi's emergency procedures. Negin Saputra is the deputy head of the village preparedness team and helps coordinate evacuations in one of the villages closest to the crater. When the volcano's alert level rises, official warnings arrive through WhatsApp messages from the geological agency. They trigger a chain of actions by emergency workers and local officials like Saputra.
Vulnerable residents are evacuated first, especially infants, pregnant women, and the elderly.
If conditions worsen, Saputra says everyone closest to the crater will be evacuated. That's when he notes that not everybody has smartphones.
Some residents, especially the elderly, don't use social media. So announcements are made through loudspeakers that are usually used for the call to prayer from mosques.
For farmers like 80-year-old Ibutemu, she is one of the people those announcements are meant to reach. She doesn't have a smartphone because she doesn't know how to use it. She used to listen to MMC FM for eruption warnings. Now, she relies on those loudspeakers and her neighbors to keep her informed. But she still turns on her radio every evening. She says ever since her son moved away, the music on the radio makes the house feel lively. The machine that was once a tool of physical survival has transitioned to an emotional one, helping her cope with the loneliness of living alone. And she has no plans of abandoning it. For NPR News, I'm Naina Rao in Mount Merapi in central Java, Indonesia.
Time now for StoryCorps. This week, we revisit a story about chosen family. Stefan Lynch was raised by gay parents at the start of the AIDS crisis in the early 1980s. At StoryCorps, he told his friend Beth Tepper about growing up.
My family were mostly gay guys who were my babysitters and the guys who, you know, took the pictures at my birthday parties. And I felt like I had this amazing family. I called them my aunties. And it was a really wonderful, amazing world that came crashing down. Starting in 82, the first person I knew died of AIDS. A young guy named Steve.
And how old were you at the time?
I was 10 when he was diagnosed. And I remember I was on the beach and I saw him and he was covered in these purple spots. And I remember asking my dad, like, what's wrong with Steve? And my dad said, oh, he has this skin cancer called Kaposi sarcoma. And I said, well, what is that? And my dad said, well, nobody really knows, but there's some gay men that are getting it. And within, I think, 2 months, Steve was dead. And it was pretty much a succession of deaths of my family throughout the next decade. My stepdad, Bill, died in 87. My dad died in 91 after a really grueling 6 months of me taking care of him. You know, I was 19, and at that point, everyone had died except for a handful of stragglers who I now hold near and dear to my heart, my aunties. It was a powerful family. There was a lot of love. And they modeled for me how to survive an epidemic even if you were dying while doing it.
Stefan Lynch and Beth Tepper for StoryCorps in San Francisco. Today, Lynch is a nursing director at an LGBTQ plus health center. Their interview is archived at the Library of Congress. By the way, StoryCorps and Morning Edition are partnering on an experiment in human connection. Meet someone on video from another part of the country and learn about their life. Your conversation becomes part of a time capsule of stories at the Library of Congress. Sign up at connect250.org. America, get ready to meet America.
Major support for StoryCorps comes from Subaru. Subaru and its retailers are partnering with Blood Cancer United this June to give blankets, patient care kits, and messages of hope to patients living with cancer. Learn more at Subaru.com/care. And from Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor can help build a comprehensive wealth plan. Learn more at Fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC.
This is NPR News.
728. Thanks for tuning in. This is People Powered KEXE. StoryCorps always has a way of making you cry, I tell you. That's Friday mornings. You hear it on Morning Edition. You can get the news of the afternoon coming up today at 4 o'clock with All Things Considered.
Support for KEXE comes from Oak Hill Assisted Living in Grand Rapids, providing personalized care in a home setting. More information at oakhillseniors.com.
And KEXE receives support from the Pines Restaurant, hosting a one-year anniversary block party tomorrow, June 27th, from noon until 10, featuring live music from Diddy Wish, Sam Miltich, and Tattletale, local vendors, food and cocktails, and a celebration of downtown Grand Rapids. More information at thepinesmn.com. Weather. We're looking at partly sunny skies today with highs 75 to 77, southeast winds 5 to 15. Mostly cloudy tonight, slight chance of showers, lows 52 to 58 degrees. And tomorrow, Saturday, it's looking great. Upper 70s to low 80s, partly sunny. It's Beltrami Block Party Day. And we're expecting breezy winds, 10 to 15, could gust up to 25. Overnight temperatures in the mid-50s.
We got a text from Jan and Warba, who sent us a link to the song that the Norwegians are singing for the FIFA World Cup. And we may hope to play that later as we get into Football is Life at 8:40.
It's making me want to, because the new season of Ted Lasso will be coming out.
Oh, yeah.
But it's making me want to rewatch Ted Lasso. I've been seeing some clips popping up. I'm sure everybody's kind of feeling that way right now. But yeah, we'll take a look for it, and we'll see if it's okay with the DJ Dang, too, if that's something he might want to hear. He maybe has something picked out for us. I don't know. Is it that time?
It is time for best wishes. We're going to wish our friends and neighbors happy birthday, happy anniversary. Today is June 26th.
John and Chris Zemke of Baxter. You guys, happy birthday to you, friends of my brother there.
Anniversary.
Oh, yeah. Did I say birthday?
Again? Yeah. And Heidi Holton and Tom Cobb, happy 22nd anniversary to you. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. Holly and Mike Newton, happy anniversary to you from Grand Rapids.
Alan and Jennifer Lipke, happy 55th in Hibbing.
Susan and Stephen Keller celebrate their 55th anniversary from Minneapolis and Deer Lake.
And David and Pamela Beckman, happy 33rd to you in Minneapolis.
Wow, it's a very popular day to get married.
Yeah.
Our very own Pat Miller, happy birthday to you today from Bemidji.
And Oni Koski, happy 71st to you in Virginia.
Fridays, we take a look at the next day as well. Brandon and Sandy Chase from Park Rapids, happy 39th wedding anniversary to you.
Another KAXE volunteer, Susan Lick, happy birthday in Grand Rapids.
And Megan Maley, another KEXE volunteer, turns 49 tomorrow from Meadowlands.
Darcy Rich, happy birthday to you in Grand Rapids. And Ruth Neustadt, turning 20 tomorrow from Marcel and Memphis.
David John Scribner, another volunteer at KEXE, happy 75th to you from Bemidji.
And Randy Gron, having a birthday tomorrow in Cook.
Here's a anniversary wish, I guess, going out today on Best Wishes.
What we need, we cannot say.
tell by my head. I was imagining jumping on the stage with a guitar. I guess I didn't want anything too sappy for an anniversary song. How about that? Some screaming.
Rock and roll.
Yeah. We do want to correct ourselves here.
Brandon and Sandy, happy 41st anniversary.
That's
to
right.
You.
They deserve a big jump and a, you know, guitar smash on the stage for 41 years.
Yeah.
Right?
And was that Grace Potter?
It was Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. Tiny Light was the name of the song.
Support for KAXE comes from the Timberlake Lodge and Hotel in Grand Rapids. On-site amenities include a restaurant with a full bar and the Grand Splash pool area with water slides and a hot tub. Further details at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com.
And thanks also goes out to Hot Tubs of Northern Minnesota on Middle School Avenue in Bemidji with hot tubs, pool tables, saunas, and more. Online at HotTubsMN.com. Big reminder again for Beltrami Block Party. Brandon and Sandy, that would be a great thing to do for your anniversary. Mm-hmm. Hope to see you there. It is tomorrow, and we've got great live music. It's free. It's right there on the street in front of Bridges Pub and Keg and Cork. And we want to thank the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund for making this possible. Bring your own chair. We've got Eric Koskinen and David Huckfeldt, Little Fevers, and more, and family-friendly activities right there on Beltrami Avenue. Hope to see you there. We'll be there.
Yes, we will.
Yeah.
Looking forward to it. Coming up before 8 o'clock, we're going to have our daily dose of phenology and what's for breakfast. We'd love to have you join us. All it takes is to be a member of KAXE. And if you're not yet a member, you can always become one right after. Mm-hmm. But we just love to get to know you and hear a bit about your breakfast and what you've got going on this weekend. And just have a fun conversation. So you can text in if you would like to join us, and then we can give you a call, 218-326-1234.
Tomorrow is the 14th annual SACZIM Bog BioBlitz. You can help document the biodiversity of the bog with experts. Nearly 4,100 species have been recorded in the greater SACZIM region. Learn more at SACZIM.org. Time now for some biodiversity and species with our very own John Latimer and our daily dose of phenology.
On today's date, June 26, 1999, the Juneberries are ripening. You may recall that the Juneberries were what we described as synchronously blooming, so all the flowers bloomed within a day or so of one another. But they are asynchronously fruiting, and so their fruit ripens sort of one today, two tomorrow, six the next day, five the day after that, then three, and then one. And so the fruit doesn't all come ripe at the same time. And there's a reason for that, and that is that they want to space out the opportunities for the fruit to actually be there and have a chance to put seeds in the ground. They're not making this fruit for us to eat, though they are delicious. They're making this fruit so that they can propagate more trees. And in order to do that, they've decided to have an asynchronous fruiting series. And what happens to us is that we're looking at the fruit thinking, oh boy, any day now, these are all going to be ripe and I'm going to have a great feast. And what really happens is that they don't ripen all at once. The robins come in and they eat all the ripe ones today, and tomorrow they'll be back and eat the ripe ones tomorrow. And this goes on for weeks and weeks, and you never really see the numbers that you're hoping to find.
Coming up, we've got some very important news about whether Taylor Swift is going to be getting married this weekend.
Okay.
To Travis Kelce, right? Then we're going to have some breakfast. Partly sunny today, highs 75 to 77, southeast winds 5 to 15, and cloudy tonight, slight chance of showers, lows 52 to 58 degrees.
Support for KAXE comes from Ledger and Ladle, a restaurant in downtown Grand Rapids with a rotating menu every few months to explore a new region, technique, or ingredient. Open Wednesday through Friday, 3 to 9. Saturdays 5 to 9, Sundays 10 to 2. More at ledgerandladle.com.
You know, I changed my mind. We're actually going to hear a story. We don't need to hear about Taylor Swift. Excitement over the World Cup is giving soccer players at historically black colleges and universities a chance to highlight the teams and gain support. So stay tuned for that story. Then we're going to be bringing you some breakfast. It is here on KAXE.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. In World Cup news, Team USA lost Thursday night to Turkey in the final minutes. Despite this setback, the U.S. won its group and will move on to the knockout stage. Throughout the U.S., soccer fans are counting on the World Cup to help grow love for the game, and that includes on the campuses of historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs. Aiding in that quest might be the fact that 13 black players are on the U.S. men's team roster this year, the most ever for an American team, and are having an impact. Brooklyn-born striker Falaron Balogun, who became the first U.S. player to score two goals in a World Cup game last week. From member station WUNC, Leonita Inge brings us the story of a new HBCU club hoping to build on that new visibility.
A DJ blasts music as teams of six players each hit the field at a stadium in Durham, North Carolina. It's the inaugural HBCU Football Club Classic, a few weeks before the World Cup. Athletes cheer each other on. They sport jerseys with team names like Equality FC, The Yard FC, and Unity FC.
Let's go, Abdul.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, there you go.
Every time.
Good try. I know that hurt.
The tournament organizer, HBCU FC, says the goal is to amplify black college culture through the global game of soccer. Raymond Brooks is the group's social media hype man. He says it's been hard work trying to get the word out.
We were going door to door to students, classrooms, HBCUs. Hey, come to the soccer tournament. Hey, join our organization at HBCU FC. Soccer? At an HBCU? I've never heard of that.
Brooks, who is black, played soccer at Mars Hill University in Western North Carolina, a predominantly white school. He says he didn't have a strong HBCU option for soccer.
If you look at a lot of person of color athletes now today is playing soccer at these big NCAA schools, they kind of, I wouldn't say regret their decisions, but they sometimes wonder and reflect what would happen maybe at a different school.
It may be hard to find a strong HBCU men's soccer team, but there was one in the early 1970s when Howard University won a national championship in men's soccer. Today, most of the soccer players at HBCUs are women. Emma Brown just finished up her freshman year at Virginia State University.
Definitely for Virginia State women's soccer, we're not just a soccer team, but we definitely are a family and we're sisters.
Her teammate, Tatiana Ward, says their sisterhood is strong because it's needed on the field, where most of their opponents don't look like them. There have been jeers and stares, she says.
I know there's been several teams who have called us names and say that we are aggressive, we're loud, we're ghetto, but we just play our game and just let that speak for itself.
But at this soccer classic, there are a lot of high fives and support.
And that is game, with Equality FC winning the HBCU FC Classic.
The young players say they hope the excitement around the World Cup will help create a soccer fan base at HBCUs as well. For NPR News, I'm Leonita Inge in Durham, North Carolina.
Hour from now, we'll be talking on the Friday morning show, Football is Life. Make sure you stay tuned for that. We'd love to hear from you this morning, especially when you hear the music that is coming up next. That is What's for Breakfast. Maybe one of the birthday or anniversary people. Wink, wink, Brandon Chase. We'd love to hear from you. We could give you some advice on anniversary presents, you know, that kind of thing. 218-326-1234. That's the number to call. Still a little bit of a chill out there this morning, which feels quite good. 58 degrees in Bagley and in Grand Rapids, 59 in Brainerd, Hibbing 56, and Bemidji reporting 59 degrees.
Support for KEXE comes from Headwaters Music and Arts in downtown Bemidji, announcing the Headwaters Fiddle Camp, inviting youth and adult string musicians with at least 1 year of playing experience for a week of music, learning, and community. The camp is Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., July 20th through the 24th. Registration deadline, July 14th. Registration at headwatersmusicandarts.org or on Facebook and Instagram.
It is time for What's for Breakfast. We need you to make that phone call, 218-326-1234.
It don't matter if you're tall. It don't matter if you're small. It don't matter if you're blue or green or any shape at all. 'Cause I'll be yours and you'll be mine to last. And we'll be friends holding fast. You don't have to be smart. You don't have to play a part. What better thing could ever be than a kindly heart? And I'll have yours and you have mine to last. We'll be friends.
It could just be a piece of toast, right? Am I right?
It could be nothing.
All right.
You don't have to eat anything.
No, it could be a smoke and a cup of coffee. Whatever you need. Join us on What's for Breakfast. We'd love to meet you today.
218-326-1234.
What friends can be. We'll be light as balloons, cows jumping over the moon.
Old wrinkles start to twinkle when they hear our tune.
And all the while we can only smile, 'cause we'll be friends coming back in style.
Well, if we don't get a guest, do we want to hear more about Taylor Swift?
I mean, that's not what my preference.
I know.
I'd rather talk to a member of KAXE and get to know him a little bit better. 218-326-1234.
Everyone will sing along, 'cause we'll be friends and they will see exactly what friends can be. We'll be light as balloons, cows jumping over the moon.
Old wrinkles start to twinkle when they hear our tune.
And all the while we can only smile, 'cause we made friends strutting back in style. Yes, we'll be friends. But won't you walk a mile with me, brother?
No, we're looking for someone for What's for Breakfast. We're thinking our engineer, Steve Noy, doesn't know that we want him to come in to be our guest on What's for Breakfast. We're putting you on the spot. Come have some breakfast with us, Steve. No, this is our time to pull up a chair to one of our members' kitchen tables. We get to know them a little bit better. Joining us in the studio is our very own engineer, Steve Noy. Morning, Steve.
Good morning, everybody.
Just pulling up a chair right here in the studio.
Yeah.
So have you eaten?
I did, yeah, actually.
Okay, what'd you have?
I had a banana and some Cinnamon Toast Crunch for breakfast.
Oh.
And I haven't had coffee yet, but I'm fixing to do that in here in a few minutes after this. So.
All right. So what kind of regular milk in your Cinnamon Toast Crunch?
Yeah, or? Regular milk. I've been drinking whole milk.
Okay.
Growing up, it was always skim milk, but my wife is used to whole milk, so.
You live in the dream.
So not even compromising with 2%.
That's right. Just more protein, milk. That's good.
Yeah. Did I say skim milk? I meant 2%, so yeah.
Okay. Oh, you're having 2%? Or your wife?
You grew up with 2%.
I grew up with 2%, yeah.
Okay.
Not the blue milk. Skim milk seems very blue.
Oh, yeah. The blue label. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. It seems thin too. It kind of. I mean, I drink skim for a long time.
You know, Ron Swanson said it best. I think it's skim milk is water pretending to be milk.
Well, he's speaking our language, Ron Swanson.
So let's go back to this banana.
Yeah.
What was the level of ripeness? Was it the kind of banana that you know ideal banana for you, or what was it like?
Well, that's a little bit of a controversy in my house. Well, you know how stores sell them, you know, almost completely green these days.
Yeah.
So that's not the way I like it. I want them to be, you know, slightly spotted with, mm-hmm. with the brown spots on them. I like them. I think they're sweeter that way.
Yeah.
So the more ripe, the better. Obviously, you don't want it to where it's like it tastes
completely
like it's
brown.
Yeah, and it tastes like it's got alcohol in it already.
Right. but that's not what everybody in your house believes.
I guess not, because I mean they'll be eating them. It grosses me out, honestly. The
texture.
The texture, and then I don't think they're sweet enough when they're, you know, still a little bit green.
Yeah,
it's just they're tough. Well, I don't know about tough. That's not the right word, but yeah, it's
yeah. I called a banana al dente once because it was a little too firm.
Yeah,
and they kind of, if it's like, now I like mine slightly green.
Okay, yeah,
we're gonna agree to disagree here.
Okay,
but when I've done too green, it's almost like you get a film on your teeth.
Mm-hmm.
All right, okay, yeah.
I don't care for that either. But
yeah,
I have a really hard time with the soft. No, I don't like any brownness
right
on
yeah
at okay. all
but so. You kind of have to just take what you have that
yeah,
morning
true.
Right,
yeah,
right
yeah yeah
so it's whatever is
yeah.
there.
And then it's hard if you want to go, you're going to go buy some bananas and all they have is the super green ones, like
okay.
should you buy them? Because sometimes they're so green they don't really ripen.
They just don't. Yeah,
they
yeah.
do that. Yeah, they do that with avocados too.
Oh yeah.
Like yeah, you're trying to find an avocado, it's like I can't eat any of these tonight.
I yeah. get my timing for avocados so wrong.
Yeah.
I almost never end up eating them because right. I'm waiting and then I wait too long and it's yeah,
yeah. too
much. It's not great.
Like I know it's that's the economical way to sell them.
Sure.
I guess. But yeah, it makes planning a lot harder.
Yeah. it can be a tricky business, yeah. the bananas, because I'm learning, like, because I have been finding them so green in the stores. It's like I got to start buying them a few days in advance
right.
of when I actually want them. So then I have to have, you know.
You got to set up reminders on your phone for
yeah.
that.
Almost.
Takes a lot more planning.
So my mom worked at a grocery store for many
years.
And
you did,
too. And I did, too. But okay. she worked there much longer than I did. And she said that, at least at her store, her produce manager could order bananas at different states of ripeness.
Oh,
like, okay.
He had a choice of how the bananas came in.
Okay.
So I don't know if that how that works
I've
everywhere,
seen a,
but.
Yeah, I've seen on social media there, I don't know if it's Singapore or somewhere else in Asia, where they have, where the grocery stores will have like a gradient of
I've seen
unripe
that too.
To ripe.
It's like goes from
banana.
Green
yeah.
to yellow to almost brown, like in a little package.
Yeah.
Of bananas.
You just walk up and choose the, you know, from mm-hmm. 1 to 10, just choose the scale that goes for you.
Okay, so here's a question for both of you. So we're starting to get into more of a regular fruit season, because I feel like mm-hmm. we go through a period where really it's only bananas that are that good. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like apples are not as good anymore.
Well, and oranges are good in the winter.
Right, but then that's tapering.
Yeah.
So at my house, I was like, I got to get some more fruit. So I got a bag of plums, which I ate on the way to work today, and some cherries, and I got a cantaloupe. And they're all getting to that good stage. Do you guys have other fruit in your house right now?
I bought some apples yesterday just because, but I'm not thrilled about them.
Yeah. Apples are ever-present in our house. They're
okay.
a constant thing. Another thing that we get a lot, especially during the summer, is watermelon.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone in my family loves watermelons, so yeah.
And I'm seeing that local berry places are starting
to get ready.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm very excited about that, because I have bought some strawberries in the store recently and they're fine, but they're not the same as
yeah.
our local strawberries.
Yeah. Have you done those? Is you and your family done that? You pick them?
Oh,
berry
we
stuff?
Might have. That's a whole lot bigger up here than it
mm-hmm.
was back in
mm-hmm.
Kansas, I imagine. But
yes.
Yeah.
But also the secret there, you can also go to those and buy them already picked.
Okay.
It's a little bit more money, but
I bet my kids would love that. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's doesn't take too long to get a box full of strawberries,
right.
if you pick them.
Okay. It is kind of fun. You jump on the back of a four-wheeler, they bring you out to the, or the little cart or something,
okay.
They bring you to where the thing is, right? I mean,
sometimes. It depends where they're picking, because
yeah.
They know where they want you to go. Like,
okay.
Here, I want you to pick here. So if it's, you know, a bit of a walk, they might give you a little ride on a cart or
okay.
something, or maybe if it's closer to where you parked, then it's not a very far walk.
Almost like a pumpkin patch kind of situation.
Yeah.
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 Okay.
That's a good thing that people might have local information on. You can tell us at 218-326-1234. So you'll be having your coffee here.
Yep.
I'm impressed by the Cinnamon Toast Crunch.
Okay.
It's a good cereal that I have not let myself... I don't think it was around when I was a kid. It's sort of a newish...
Really?
Yeah, look at my age.
I'm sorry.
Come on. I know. But I would have loved it. And so it came out when I was eating less.
Okay.
Or my mom didn't let us get it. Jennifer's on the...
How
old am I? Right?
Just the Wikipedia.
Cinnamon Toast Crunch history. Let's see. When did this...
I mean, I would have it with my nephew when he was little. And I'd remind him...
You are correct, Heidi. It didn't come out till 1984.
Yeah.
For some reason, I just assumed that it's been around forever.
Well, for us, it was, yeah.
I mean, pretty much.
Four years old, yeah.
You have to get it at the, so you don't get Cinnamon Toast soggy. I mean,
right,
you got to
yeah.
eat it in a certain amount of time, you
right.
know?
Of course, when I was a kid, I mean, I laugh at this now, but when I was a kid, the soggy Cinnamon Toast Crunch was actually my favorite.
Oh, well.
There you go.
I was a weird kid.
We just heard from Mickey. She's on her way to go pick strawberries at a local patch right now.
Okay.
So they're starting to open up.
Yeah. It's happening. I was just gonna say, I used to eat a lot of cereal, and I have gotten completely out of cereal mode. I just do oatmeal.
Okay. Even in summertime, huh?
Yep. I find it that's what works
point.
Best for me.
That's a good point. The cold milk in the summer.
Right.
I had never thought of that.
I don't really care for, I don't eat a lot of oatmeal, but I definitely don't in the summer. It doesn't feel summer breakfast to
okay.
me. So.
All right.
But I mean, I eat warm other breakfast, you know, eggs or something like that. So I don't
sure.
know why.
Yeah.
Feeling that way.
Hmm.
Well, we've got the holiday approaching and so much going on I'm sure.
Yep.
It's kind of crazy. Even early this week, we're starting to see a lot more traffic in town here, and
yeah.
It's swelling.
Yep.
You guys have, do you know what you're going to be doing for your 4th of July?
Not much for 4th of July.
Okay.
I know that the week following that, we are headed to Wisconsin Dells.
Oh.
We're going to do, we're finally heading there during the summer when things are going to be open.
Things will be
hopping. The water parks and things like that. So we're finally taking the plunge, and we're gonna get the real experience. So
taking the plunge, I see what you did there.
Yeah.
Do you enjoy a water park? What would be your favorite thing at a water park?
My way of enjoying a water park is the kids having fun, and I am kicking back, and I don't know if I'm going to have I'll probably have a drink of some kind, you know, you kind of think of the Kokomo thing with the tropical drink melting in your hand. That's probably